Programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
You are tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we take a look at one of the most successful players in the airline industry today. Our guest is journalist Barbara Peterson. Her latest book looks at the success of JetBlue. The title of the book, Blue Streak, Inside JetBlue, the upstart that rocked an industry. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls for Barbara Peterson this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Barbara Peterson is a contributing editor at Condé Nast Traveler. Her work has also appeared in a number of newspapers, including the New York Times, and she is the co-author with James Glab of Rapid Descent, Deregulation, and the Shakeout in the Airlines. Her new book, Blue Streak, Inside JetBlue, the Upstart That Rocked an Industry, is published by Portfolio, a division of Penguin. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Barbara Peterson, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. JetBlue first came on the scene about 5 years ago, the creation of an entrepreneur named David Neeleman. He started an airline during a recession, and he's held on since then, including through September 11th. I know that we'll talk more about him later in the interview, but I thought here at the outset, maybe you could give us some sense of the man and what makes him tick.
David Neeleman is actually a very interesting character. He is not, I guess, what you'd call your standard issue, you know, airline executive or corporate executive. I mean, he's not one of these sort of button down types. His background is, as you mentioned, he's an entrepreneur. He comes from Utah. He was a Mormon missionary. When he was 18, he went off to Brazil and worked there for 2 years as a missionary. And he also suffers from ADD, which wasn't diagnosed, actually, until fairly recently. It was really just, you know, he was just chalked up to being a poor student. And for years, he had to deal with the fact that he had a lot of trouble doing very ordinary things, like reading and writing. And that was I think that sort of helped inform his personality. Because when he went to Brazil as a teenager, that was really the first time in his life when actually he had succeeded at doing something. And he discovered that he really did have a gift of relating to people. And he did quite well there. He converted something like 200 people, which is a huge number for a missionary. And then he returned to Salt Lake City and went back to school and promptly dropped out. And that's when he started up his first travel-related venture.
Yeah, and that was?
And that was actually a sort of a tour company. He had heard about somebody who had these condos in Hawaii that were just sitting there empty. You couldn't seem to rent them out. So Neeleman, you know, like so many entrepreneurs, he sees an opportunity, and most people wouldn't act on it. But he immediately said, hey, let's get some people over there, and we'll fill up those condos, and I'll make a nice little profit by marking up the price. And so suddenly he had a business with 20 employees making a couple million, or at least bringing in a couple million in sales every year. However, he also got his first taste of what the industry can be like. The airline charter company he had contracted with to bring these people to Hawaii went out of business literally overnight, and that can happen in the airline business. It's a very tough business. And mm-hmm. so what happened was he was left literally holding the bag. He lost all the money he'd had at that point. And I think, he resolved he would never let that happen again. And in fact, every other business he's gotten into since then has been very successful.
Yeah. Well, now after reading your book, when I think of him, I think of tenacity. I think he has a gift with people. He's got great people skills. He's an entrepreneur. He's an innovator.
Yes. Well, the innovator part of him really came out a few years later. And in fact, you know, these days when you travel by air, most people don't have a paper ticket. In fact, that's almost seems like kind of a quaint little relic from the old days. You know, paper ticket, who needs that? Well, David Neeleman was really the first person who came up with the idea and actually implemented the idea of electronic ticketing for travelers. And that is one of many innovations he's made, which has, you know, made the airlines more efficient, especially his airline, because his airline is the only all e-ticket airline still in the country. You're absolutely right. That is the kind of person he is. He is an innovator. He's someone who sees a situation that could really stand some improvement, like a lot of aspects of air travel, and then actually goes out and thinks of ideas of ways to do it. You know, another thing he did was create this whole network of at-home reservationists. You know, most airlines have these big reservation centers, you know, these call centers. And that can be a problem, because if there are situations that suddenly increase the number of calls coming in, let's say a delay situation or a blizzard or whatever, they can't meet that demand. You know, so that's why so many of us spend, you know, a lot of time on hold in airlines. But he thought, well, you know, here's a way I can save money and have happier employees, because he has people who are working out of their homes and they have flexible hours, and he's so that's again the kind of thing that he's done, which is almost considered to be heresy in the airline business. Airlines are very hidebound. They don't really adapt very easily, or they haven't in the past, let's put it that way.
And, yeah. So. Let's talk now about JetBlue. What sets that carrier apart from the others?
Well, it really started out as David Neeleman's concept was to create a better Southwest. It really was originally just conceived to be a budget airline, but with something more, you know, with a little more style, if you will. And I think what happened is, as it evolved, it really did become a very different airline and a real departure from what we were accustomed to in this country. I guess you could say, from one standpoint, it's unusual because it's actually profitable. Now, from the consumer standpoint, what is attractive is that it was a budget startup airline with all new planes. And that maybe doesn't seem so radical right now, because most airlines now have younger fleets than they did, say, 5 years ago. But at the time, that was very unusual. Most startup airlines would start out with used planes because they're cheaper at the outset. Well, Neeleman said, wait a minute, you know, the problem is that's why most budget airlines get a bad name. Now, they start out with these old planes and they break down, and, you know, then we get a reputation for being unreliable, and the whole thing spirals downhill. So his at the time radical notion was, let's raise a lot of money and buy all new planes, and then we'll start out with in a sense a fresh start. We'll have new planes, people prefer them, they won't break down as much, ultimately they'll save money because, you know, they burn less fuel. All those aspects came into play, and it turned out to be one of the smartest things he ever did, because it has in fact really set the standard. You know, it's raised the bar in the business.
And all those new planes allowed him to put television sets.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that was another thing. It was partly just serendipity. At the time, they were really, you know, putting the finishing touches on what their kind of service would be in 1999, actually. A new company had just started up that was trying to sell airlines on the idea that they could actually have live television on their flights, which had never been done before. You know, it was at best it was canned programming, you know, and most often on a screen hanging in the middle of the cabin. And so everything came together at that point. They said, well, here's this company. They would love us to be their launch customer. We'll sign on. But then there was a big debate over, well, how are we going to pay for this? And, you know, at first they were thinking they would charge the customers, and then that got very complicated. Well, how do you do that, and what do you charge, and what if you have a family of four, and they're not going to want, you know, mm-hmm. it just got too complicated. So they said, okay, well, we'll offer it free for a few months. Well, it's still offered free today, 5 years later, and that's because it ended up really almost paying for itself. I mean, they figured out it was probably about $1 a passenger that it was costing them. And they don't serve meals, and they don't do a lot of other things like that. So they save money on not offering, you know, the old mystery meals, you know, that everybody hated anyway. You know, so, again, that's just an example of what you can do if you really decide to be a little more innovative, you know, be a little more creative in your thinking about these things.
Yeah, boy. Jokes about airline food have gone the way of the dinosaurs.
Well, unfortunately, these days there is really no free meal anymore in the back of the plane. Almost every major airline now is offering meals for sale or just not offering them at all.
Yeah. Now, this was really interesting. The odds of getting a job at JetBlue today, 80 to 1. And at the same time, the carrier is expanding. And when you were doing the reporting and writing for this book, JetBlue had plans to grow rapidly. How big does JetBlue want to be, and where are they in terms of realizing their goal for expansion?
Yes, well, they are growing very rapidly, and that was, I think, always part of their plan all along, because I think that's one way to keep costs down, is you keep on expanding, you keep on adding planes, you constantly, you know, in other words, you constantly have more new planes coming on, so that lowers the overall age of your fleet. But, yes, you're absolutely right. They've grown in 5 years from two planes, you know, which is what they started out with on day one, to 71 planes. They have more than 8,000 employees, and they're going to double in size within 5 years. And, you know, if you look at the planes that they have on order or have options to buy, their fleet could be well over 200 planes in, I'd say, in the next 8 years, maybe not even that. It's really going to be a sizable airline. It already is a major airline in the sense that it, you know, they take in sales of more than $1 billion a year, which is what the federal government's definition of a major airline is, by the way. I mean, it still is hardly the size of a Southwest or an American, but if they continue growing the way they plan to, they will be in that league.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book that Southwest grew at a glacial pace. And here we have this upstart growing so rapidly. I wonder what are the challenges of holding together a startup, because it's only 5 years.
Yes.
Through that kind of rapid rate of growth.
Yes. Well, part of the reason why Southwest didn't start out growing as fast as JetBlue is because Southwest really was started up before deregulation. Southwest began as an intrastate carrier in Texas. So almost by definition, they were limited. I mean, literally limited within the borders of Texas until after 1978. And then there were numerous other restrictions on how fast they could expand. So part of it was just, you know, that was a different era then. And later on, though, they did get more into the idea that if they expand into a new city, that they shouldn't do it halfway. They shouldn't tiptoe in. They should come in really big. And the reason is that the big airlines traditionally respond to new competition just by, you know, clobbering the new guy. You know, I mean, they add on lots of flights. They lower their fares to the newcomers' levels. There are all sorts of ways that the established airlines have traditionally fought back against challenges. So JetBlue, starting up, you know, in the late 1990s and, you know, early 2000, they had to really approach it in a very different way. You see, one thing that has often killed startup airlines is because they start out too modestly. They don't have a chance to really make much of an impression, and then by the time the big guy is finished with them, it's too late. You know, I mean, they're, you know, that scenario had been repeated so many times in the 80s and the 90s that when David Neeleman drew up his plan, and I think initially he wasn't convinced that that was the way to go, but he became convinced that the only way they could succeed was to really expand and to, you know, get out there in a big way. And that makes it a lot harder for the, you know, the old established airlines to strike back. And I think so far his strategy has actually been borne out.
Yeah, yeah. But I wonder, though, anytime you're growing a business that quickly, I'm not a business person, but I would imagine that holding it together is got to be tough. I can imagine that, number one, you've got to keep plugging in money. You got to have the investors there to back you.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right, and that is the one question that they get asked a lot, and David Neeleman, in fact, asks himself all the time. He doesn't wait for somebody else to bring this up. It's a constant, almost obsession of his, is how do we grow this company and maintain the small company feel, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the one answer is just to really pay attention to your employees, not just the hiring and the training process, which I go into extensively in the book. I mean, I myself took a training class, which is one of the chapters in the book, but also to make sure that once people are out there on their jobs, that they aren't kind of, forgotten about. And a couple of years ago, and I write about this in the book, they sort of had a wake-up call. They survey their employees every year and ask them to really be honest. In fact, it's all anonymous. So you don't have to worry about losing your job if you really don't like your supervisor. I mean, you can be totally honest and tell them what you think of the company and where things could be better. And they got a very surprising result a couple of years ago, which is that they were promoting people too fast to be managers. And people weren't, treating their underlings very well, at least some of them were. So that was good. They said, okay, well, we realize, yes, maybe we have been mm-hmm. growing too fast and we aren't paying attention to this, and how do you move people into mm-hmm. leadership roles? So they came up with a new training program, and the bottom line is that's something that you have to constantly focus on. I should point out, too, that one of the things that I think encourages them that this is possible, even in the airline business, is that Southwest Airlines is, it's, as I mentioned, it's a huge airline. It's got 30,000 employees, and yet it is usually listed as one of the best companies to work for in the country, and it does have this very sort of boosterish sort of in-house company culture. I mean, mm-hmm. If you've ever seen their ads or if you've ever seen flown on them or anything, that's a big part of who they are. That didn't happen accidentally. It's something that is constantly worked on. They even have something called a culture committee, which almost sounds like a contradiction in terms. It sounds like, inevitably there will be more bureaucracy, but as part of that, you just have to keep your eyes on that whole aspect of the company, the customer service. So yes, it is a challenge, and often when companies grow very fast, service suffers. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't happened here yet.
Barbara Peterson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a journalist. Her latest book is Blue Streak, Inside JetBlue, the Upstart That Rocked an Industry. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And we've got a listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line, line 4, a caller in Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello. I was wondering if how much analysis you did in the whole area of cheap airlines. I was wondering what the percentage is of those who start out and actually those who make it. I know in the small business community it's about 80%, 80-85 fail within, a year or 2 years. And I'm just wondering what it was like in that sense, in that area, in the sense that they really don't have any competition except the big boys. And since they fit a nice niche, they sort of have an advantage, particularly now since the big boys have been hit pretty hard and haven't since put their money around the right places. The second question deals with business world, oftentimes when smaller corporations move up to become bigger ones, they slip and they're gone. And I was wondering if you thought about that with this group, because they seem to be having your eye on the big pie part instead of the one that they're doing pretty well at right now. Thanks a lot.
Okay, good questions.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, well, actually, that first one, that's a subject that I'm very interested in, because I actually wrote a book on the initial, you know, sort of reaction to airline deregulation. That was 10 years ago, and there were more than 100 airlines started up and failed in the initial sort of burst of activity after deregulation in 1978. And I would say, historically, something like over 90% of new airlines fail. And that's partly, you know, as your question points out, it's very tough for new companies in any industry. But there are particular aspects of the airlines that makes it even tougher. So, yes, well, startups have some advantages. You know, they have lower costs typically. They can pick and choose the routes where they go into a little bit, you know, more. So, but it, you know, the I'd say the casualty rate in the airlines has always been very, very high. And maybe some people remember People Express Airlines. And that was the darling of the deregulators. You know, it was the big success. It, you know, $29 fares. It was said to be cheaper than driving. And it was a huge success for a while. And then what happened was they went off what they were doing well, which is gets to your second question, which is whether or not as they grow, they might slip because they might, you know, not stick to their knitting, so to speak. And People Express is a very cautionary tale. They grew way too fast. They started buying big planes that didn't really fit in with the type of service they offer. They were flying 747s to London and Paris, and they lost a huge amount of money on that because they just were getting into areas that they just didn't know how to do very well. And then they merged with another airline, which the old Frontier, that's not, it has no connection with the airline that is now known as Frontier. And there was a terrible culture clash there, and it was just a disaster. And then, you know, the rest is history. I mean, they went out of business soon after that. So in answer to your question about whether or not JetBlue will go down that path or not, well, I think most of the people involved with JetBlue have had years of experience in the airlines and are very aware of the pitfalls. And I can't see them making a blunder of that magnitude, you know, such as, you know, merging with another airline. And frankly, I think the age of airline mergers is long past anyway, because most of them have been terrible. So, in answer to your question, I would think they've got the eye on the ball. But yes, it is always a risk when companies expand.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. I'm going to get another listener waiting to talk with us. I want to get to that call in just a second here. But it is interesting that when you talk with David Neeleman, he's been a visionary. He's a cautious visionary, and he says, you know, well, I don't know. You know, it's too early to tell how we're doing and what we've accomplished. Come back in another 5 years, Barbara. Right?
Yes. Well, actually, he tried to discourage me from writing the book now because he said, oh, it's way too early to tell the story. Mm.
Let's talk with a listener in Chicago on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you. Actually, your commentator's comments a little earlier about as long as they're expanding and growing, they keep prices down. That's half the definition of a classic pyramid scheme, which is what almost all major airlines have been since day one of the airline industry in the United States. Airlines have never been profitable. They only continue to exist because of huge subsidies from local and state and federal government. The vast majority of airline flights in the United States travel less than 600 miles. That's exactly the distance that ought to be serviced by a decent rail system. While I'm sure you might not agree, since you've studied this so long, you probably have a certain affinity for the industry, it's an industry that we should pull the plug on and let it die and be used for long-distance travel, overseas travel, that is what it's actually good for, instead of destroying the rail network, which it continues to do. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, actually, I'm a real rail fan. I love railroads. I wish we had more of them. So, no, I don't see any contradiction there, really. I do, you know, and I do think that the country really ought to have more of a dialogue over, you know, where the government role ought to be. You know, and there are some people who have really criticized the government support, you know, that came after 9/11. Not so much the initial payout that went to airlines, essentially to repay them for the 3 days of government-ordered grounding. But, you know, the loan guarantee board that was set up has kept airlines like U.S. Airways in business, and some have questioned whether or not that's necessarily a good thing if you're keeping alive a company that might not make it in a free market. So, you know, while I don't really necessarily get into that type of argument in the book, you know, except to quote David Neilman when he says, you know, basically, hey, look, it's not a level playing field. You know, I mean, we're competing against, you know, either airlines that are in Chapter 11 or getting government handouts or both. And that's not really, you know, again, it's not really a fair playing field. On the other hand, some people have said, well, these low fare guys are sort of cherry picking the fat routes, you know, that the big airlines have long had. And it's, you know, so you could argue it both ways. I think ultimately what's lacking is we've never really had much of a government dialogue about where the role is. I mean, this is an industry that was regulated tightly by the government for 40 years. And then suddenly it was let loose, you know, to compete. And you could almost argue that they're still working that out, you know. It's tough to take a business that was regulated like a public utility and suddenly say, okay, guys, you're on your own.
Yeah. Where do you think the old line carriers are headed at this point? You mentioned U.S. Air, and there was an article recently in the New York Times I have here, you know, the airline that refused to die, facing many challenges still, but, you know, you look at what they've done and a little blurb here from the article. Some airline workers at U.S. Airways have given up so much that they're now making less than a cashier at Walmart.
Oh, yes. No, I know. It's a really terrible situation right now. This has been the longest continuous losing streak in the airline's history. And that's saying a lot because the airlines have been known for these boom and bust cycles, you know, virtually for their entire existence, especially after deregulation. But the last 5 years have just been, truly a disaster for the large airlines. And the reason for that is just that they have much higher fixed costs. And when, you know, something happens like 9/11 and the recession on top of that, and then the Iraq war and oil prices spiking, you know, they can't just suddenly say, okay, we're going to lop off our costs by 30%. It's much more complicated than that. And they have large fleets, some of which are very old. You know, I mean, some of their planes are 20 years or 30 years old. Those planes are far less fuel efficient. They have workers who are expecting to get pensions, and though they may not, because, you know, that's, again, a whole other issue they're grappling with. So, where is it heading? Well, as you say, it's, you know, everybody had already sort of decided that U.S. Airways was history, and then it surprised everybody by not agreeing to go quietly. And, you know, it's very hard to finally kill an airline, as somebody said. Mm-hmm. That is just because airlines do have a constituency. You know, most airlines that are any size at all have a local constituency. They've got help in, you know, in high places, and they usually can pull together some sort of rescue package that will enable them to keep on going. And, you know, an airline like Pan Am had been really on life support for the last 25 years of its existence, and, you know, yet it hung on. So I'm not saying that's good or bad. You know, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think there are reasons why we want to have a viable airline business. We depend on airlines. You know, our whole country does. It's an essential part of our whole fabric. So, but I do think that, again, it's tough to see where this is going to all end. I mean, most people do believe at some point one of the large airlines is just going to have to go out of business completely. As we saw, you know, in the early 90s, Pan Am and Eastern. And then later, of course, TWA, mm-hmm. They're no longer flying. I don't know what, you know, I would not want to speculate on which ones are going to make it because that's just really not useful. But I think that that's where it's heading.
There have been so many things over the years since 1978. You mentioned deregulation. And then there was that merger and acquisition craziness of the 80s. There was the firing of the air traffic controllers. There's 9/11. All these things have just, have any of these factors completely shaken out? You know, is the industry still coping with, you know, as you mentioned, they are still, it is still coping with the deregulation of 78. But, you know, you look at some of the other things that have happened over the years, you wonder if there's been a bounce back from all that other stuff.
No, I think you're right. You know, I mean, people inside the industry are fond of saying that, you know, the losses of the past few years have been so great that they've wiped out the industry's entire profits that they've made since the Wright brothers. And you know, I mean, I'm sure that's true. And they're constantly catching up. And, you know, any one thing can completely throw them off. You know, you mentioned the air traffic controller strike. That was terrible. That was actually really bad for the startups that had just come up as a result of deregulation, because they weren't that big. And the government basically said, oh, you have to cut back all your flights because, you know, we don't have enough controllers to serve you. So all of those things have been, you know, really, really and just compounding the basic flaws of the business. It's not a business. In fact, you know, you could really argue that maybe it shouldn't be deregulated. Maybe we should go back to regulation because, you know, it is really in some ways more like a public utility. However, you know, we have to remind ourselves that airfares are really at, you know, historic lows right now. And air travelers really are getting a better deal than they would have if we had continued with economic regulation of the airlines. So one could say that this is almost a subsidy, in a sense, in a strange way, of the public. I mean, with that, you know, the fact you can fly to the West Coast and back, you know, from New York, for example, for $200, that's pretty extraordinary. Now, I know that not every part of the country gets that kind of fair competition, but there's certainly a lot more people now who have a choice of carrier and have good fares to choose from than there would have been in the past.
You write early in the book about a customer who told you that he had 1,000,000 miles in his American Airlines frequent flyer account, and he told you he would not use them. He must have had a very terrible experience with that carrier. So now he's on JetBlue, and, you know, I wonder, you know, is he or will he become a loyal customer? Can you have a loyal customer base in today's market?
Yes. Well, actually, what he really meant was he wasn't going to use those 1,000,000 miles on to fly again on American. But there's certainly plenty of other ways he could get rid of those miles. But still, it was a very telling thing. And I think that what has happened is, you know, those frequent flyer programs, that's really interesting.
That's another sore spot with travelers, too, isn't it?
Yes. I was just going to say, you know, when they started up in the early 1980s, in fact, American was the first one that had a frequent flyer program, it really was effective in getting passengers loyalty. However, now it's become so ubiquitous, and everybody's, you know, you've got 1,000,000 different ways of earning miles, you know, and you've got your tie-in credit card, and you've got... Oh, you know, just as you know, you never actually had to set foot on an airplane to get a lot of miles. But what's happened is overall that's acted to sort of dilute the value of the miles. And just in the past year or so, you know, because I also write for Condé Nast Traveler magazine, and I do stories for them from time to time on these sorts of things. And we've been hearing from a lot of our readers who are just very disgruntled over the state of these loyalty programs. They say that you know, you can't use your award to travel. I mean, it's just very hard for the routes and that are popular and the times that you want to fly. You know, typically they don't really have very many seats available. And now even upgrading to first class, which was really, that was sort of the holy grail of the business traveler. You know, if you could get enough miles to upgrade to the front cabin, then you'd be happy. Then then the plan would be doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is cementing that loyalty to a company. Well, it's getting very, very hard to do that now. So I think what the big airlines are faced with now is you know, the point of these loyalty programs, if they are ending up alienating the very people that they were intended to, you know, bind to the company, you know, to really, you know, that what I'm referring to is the road warriors, you know, the people who travel 10 or 20 trips a year. And that's really typically been the airline's gravy. You know, those are the people who make them profitable or not. So I think now they're really at a crossroads here, is whether or not these programs are going to really survive in their present form. Now, an airline like JetBlue can't have a big frequent flyer like that. I mean, they do have a frequent flyer plan. It is more like a green stamp sort of thing. You know, each flight you take, you get a number of points, and the points expire after 1 year. It's not by any means the most generous program out there, but they do have it, and I think they feel that, you know, that's not the point. They're giving you better fares. They're giving you what they feel is good service. So we don't need to do all of that other stuff.
Hmm. And one thing that's very important in JetBlue is its employees. And if in Neelman's words, if you treat them right, they will treat the customers right.
Yes.
So how does the airline go about training its employees to have that kind of, to create that culture?
Yes, well, that was a big part of what I wanted to do in the book. And actually, what I did do was I took the 3.5-week flight attendant training course. So I took the whole thing, and I wanted to see what it would be like to go through that, almost from the point of view of somebody who was just hired by the company. And it was really kind of strange. I mean, it was, I guess I described it at one point as a cross between charm school and police academy, because you really almost have a dual role there. You know, one is to be the ingratiating sort of customer service, you know, representative, you know, to, and they do, I think, a very good job of that. They constantly reinforce the idea that, you know, you're out there, you're on the front lines, you're really a big reason why people come back to us. You know, that's you know, all these interactions that you have with the customers are really going to make the big difference. And by the way, at the end of the year, you know, if we're profitable, you're going to get a piece of that. So they really have done a very good job of getting across the idea that the actions that you take while on the job will really ultimately make a difference in one comes, you know, back in your pocket at the end of the year. And I think that's one thing that a lot of service industries have kind of lost touch with, you know, that connection there between what you do and how well the company does. I think some of the larger airlines, and it's understandable why the employees there would think this, but I think they feel like, oh, what difference does it make? You know, I mean, I've been really working hard and my pay's just been cut 30%. And, you know, as you mentioned, some of these people at U.S. Airways are making the equivalent of what they'd make is, you know, a cashier at Walmart. So that's really the bottom line. I mean, they emphasize it a lot in training, but they also emphasize, I guess, you know, dealing with the sorts of situations that can come up when you've got hundreds of people being crammed into these, you know, claustrophobic planes. And I mean, you know, I mean, I'm just saying claustrophobic is some people really would find that confining no matter what airline they're on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we had to do in flight training was how do you deftly handle a situation where a customer is being abusive to you, or you've got, I mean, just all manner of things that can come up. And that's really where they prove their mettle, I think, because, you know, those are the situations that are tough, not just, you know, gee, it's, you know, if you have clear weather every day, you can always run a good airline, right? You can have airline, you know, the airline will be on time, people will be happy, they'll get there. It's what you do when things go wrong that is really the key. And all I can say is when I went through this training class, that was a big part of what we were doing. You know, we were just constantly talking about what could come up and role-playing to see how to handle things. And not everybody made it through the class. You know, it's hard enough to even get an interview at JetBlue, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's once you get in the training class, you're already hired, and yet you can still flunk out. So and we had a couple of people who flunked out of our class.
Well, how do you flunk out?
Oh, well, you know, it's really tough. I don't think a lot of flyers really understand how tough these classes are. I mean, you're in class for like 12 hours a day. You have lots of tests. You've got written tests. You've got oral examinations. You have to be able to show you can evacuate an aircraft in 90 seconds. And any stage along the way, if you don't pass, you know, you maybe get one other chance, but then you're out, you know.
Is JetBlue unionized?
No, it isn't. And, of course, that's another big question mark that, mm-hmm. that a lot of people will bring up if you talk about JetBlue. They'll say, okay, well, for now they're not union. What's going to happen, you know, down the road? Well, first of all, most startup airlines don't really start out unionized. I mean, most startup companies don't start out organized. And, in fact, in the past, most airlines didn't last long enough for it to even be an issue, you know. So they started out with a, I guess, you know, maybe it was sort of a utopian idea, but the idea was, wait a minute, if we sit down and talk to our employee groups and ask what they want, and if we try to give them everything that they would get through a union, you know, then why would we need one? Why, I mean, you know, why would we need essentially what is a middleman? So while most airlines are heavily unionized, in fact, Southwest, ironically, because it's known for being such a heavy place to work, Southwest is the most highly unionized large airline, I think, in the country. All of its employee groups are union. And I just point that out by way of saying I don't think it would really destroy JetBlue by any means if they ultimately did become unionized. But I think at this point what they're trying to do is see if they can work with the union, different employee groups without that. Their pay scales are basically not any lower than a union airline. I think they're basically sort of similar to Southwest, maybe a bit higher in some of the other entry-level jobs because, you know, you have a lot of people living in New York City. That's an expensive place to live. But certainly, as long as you pay your workers well and pay them what they would get in another company that is unionized, you give them good working conditions, I don't think it should be an issue.
Yeah. I'm thinking now of David Neeleman, and when he worked with Herb Kelleher at Southwest for a while, not very long, but he was so frustrated because he was discouraged from speaking up. And it seems to me that at JetBlue, employees are encouraged to speak up. Is that the case?
Yes, I think so. Now, you know, I should also add a caveat here. I mean, I know that, you know, it might sound like, oh, gee, JetBlue is just one big happy family. And, you know, it's not. I mean, you know, it's a big company, and any big company is going to have some issues. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, there was a big sort of brouhaha a couple of years ago about some people who felt that the supervisors were getting a little power rant. So, I mean, but yes, they do have. I'd say they that's something they do focus on. They have these monthly, they call them pocket sessions, but essentially they're like town hall meetings. And David Neeleman and Dave Barger, who's the president of JetBlue, and is also a very important person in the company. He and David are almost like a team. David and Dave are known as they go around to various crew bases. You know, the biggest one is at JFK, but they go to, you know, Fort Lauderdale and some of the other places where they have a lot of employees, and they basically stand up in front of them and say, "Hey, ask us anything you want." And they also put this on the company intranet, so people who can't be at JFK or wherever can still listen to it and listen to what's going on in the company. And then they send people out to every airport that the airline flies to. At least once a month, they send a top officer of the company. It may not necessarily be David or Dave, but it will be somebody who has influence, and they do the same thing. They say, you know, please just tell us what's on your minds. And so far, that seems to be very effective. When I interviewed people at the company, and these were people who, by the way, knew I wasn't going to quote them by name. There wouldn't be any fallout from talking to me. They always brought that up before I did, even, as saying that's really one of the things that differentiated JetBlue from other companies they'd worked for.
Mm. Other companies, are they taking a look at JetBlue and the way David and Dave run things there and saying, you know, what can we learn from this? Maybe our culture is different, but, you know, we can pick some things here up from their plan, and we can make our company better.
Yes. Well, yes, I think I've seen already some evidence of that in the airlines. There's actually a funny story, which I wrote about in the book, which was American Airlines sent somebody around to, you know, sort of try out, you know, different services on the airlines. And they had a little checklist, you know, different things like, okay, what's it like on board? You know, does somebody smile when you get on the plane? Do they, you know, all those little things, all, you know, basically trying to find out how their service stacks up against ours. And most airlines, by the way, do that. You know, they send these people out anonymously as sort of scouts or spies or whatever you want to call it. But the funny thing is that when the when the person flew on JetBlue, they left. Now, maybe it wasn't completely unintentional, but they left this thing sitting in the seat pocket, which was basically their comments on JetBlue and all the other airlines, and, you know, compared with their own. And they gave JetBlue the highest marks in every category. And essentially, they said, I don't know how we're going to be able to compete with them, you know, because they do everything so well. They actually came and they asked my name, and they came back and asked me if I wanted seconds on the drinks. And I mean, they, you know, it was very interesting, very revealing. And soon after that, a memo went out to a lot of people at that airline, basically saying, "Here's how we ought to start treating our customers." Now, that's just one example, but, I mean, we've seen a couple of the large airlines start up their own sort of JetBlue wannabes. You know, we've had Delta Song and United's TED, and and you'll notice that a lot of their advertising and a lot of what they're trying to project in their, their public, anyway, their public images, is that, gee, we're really nice and we'll treat you well and friendly and all that. No, I don't know. Suddenly everybody has woken up to this idea that paying customers ought to be treated with respect. I mean, but yes, as far as the whole in-house culture that makes that kind of thing possible, yeah, I think that is definitely a lot harder to change, when you've had companies that have been in business for years and years and years, but it's not impossible. Yeah. And David Neeleman does go around a lot to speak at various industry groups, not just travel industry. I mean, just all over the country. That's a big part of what he does. And I think that, he's sort of spreading the message.
He's a missionary after all.
Right? Exactly.
Well, we've got to wrap up here. We're straying past time just a little bit. But before I go, I do want to ask you just for a couple of quick observations on the new Airbus. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very exciting. It's really refreshing to see something really new in this business. You know, this is not a business where there's a lot of cutting edge ideas and technology. You know, I mean, the last big breakthrough, I think, was the jet engine. You know, and so I think it's very exciting, which, again, is good for the industry. However, I think it's going to be a while before we see it in the United States. You know, no U.S. airlines yet have bought it, and airports are going to have to really make major adjustments, to their facilities to be able to even allow that thing to, pull up to the gate.
Well, we'll see. Barbara, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Journalist Barbara Peterson has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book, Blue Streak Inside JetBlue, The Upstart That Rocked an Industry. She's also co-author of Rapid Descent, Deregulation and the Shakeout in the Airlines. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste. It was indeed a very interesting day on the Board of Trade, particularly in the soybean pit, where beans got off to a rip-roaring start. And actually, the March contract, a high on the day of 561, in the May of 567, before pulling back significantly just before the closing bell, giving up much of those gains, still finishing to the upside, however. We'll talk about the implications of that with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities at 2:06 Central Time on the closing market report. Let's go ahead, though, and start in the wheat pit, give you the full settlements. March contract, a high on the day of 297, a low of 293.5, settling 296, up a half. May, a high of 305.5, a low of 301.5, settling 304, up 3/4. July, a high of 312, a low of 309, settling 311, unchanged on the day. September, a high of 318, a low of 315.25, settling 316.5, also unchanged. December, a high of 327.5, a low of 323.5, settling 323.75, down 3/4 on the day. March corn, a high of $2.75, a low of 199.25, settling right on that psychological $2 mark and above its 10-day moving average, up 3/4 on the day. May, a high of 208.75, a low of 206.5, settling 207.75, up 3/4. July, a high of 216, a low of 214, settling 214.75, up 3/4. September, a high of 223, a low of 221.5, settling 221.5 unchanged on the day. December, a high of 232.75, a low of 230.75, settling 231.5 up a half. March, a high of 239.5, a low of 238.25, settling 238.5 up a half on the day. March Oats, a high of 159.5, a low of 156.25, settling 159.5 up 3. May, a high of 153.25, a low of 151, settling 151.25 down 3/4. And then those soybeans. The March contract, 2 weeks now, a high on the plus to the upside, 34 cents. The Noves, 2 weeks up to the plus side, 49.5 cents. These are some levels that our analysts are saying you should do some marketings at. Again, Mike Zuzulo should have more about that in just a few minutes. March beans, a high of 561, a low of 548.5, settling 552.5 up a half. May, a high of 567, a low of 551, settling 555.75 up 2.75. July, a high of 571, a low of 554.5, settling 559.25 up 3. August, a high of 570, a low of 558, settling 562 up 2.5. September, a high of 568, a low of 561, settling 561.75 up 7.75. November, a high of 578.25, a low of 564, settling 570.25 up 3.75 on the day. And then in the soybean meal pit, the March contract, a high of 174, a low of 169, settling 169.20 down 230. May, a high of 174.50, a low of 169.80, settling 170.10 down 110. March soybean oil, a high of 2018, a low of 1980, settling 2007 up 25. The May contract, a high on the day of 2033, a low of 1992, settling 2020 up 31 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where Celeste, feeders, and lives both took it strongly on the chin today, I believe in anticipation of a cattle on feed report that's due out in just about 3 minutes.
Okay, so I suspect we'll hear about that in the closing market report. Let's take a look at what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeders, $100.45 the high, the low 98.30, the settlement 98.30, that down 232.5. April 99.85, the high 97.80, the low 97.85, the settlement, that down 210. May 98.75, the high 96.80, the low, the settlement 97.10, down 175. February live cattle, 89.90, the high 88.75, the low 88.95. The settlement, that down 155. April, 86.80, the high 85.35, the low 85.45, the final price, that down 185. April lean hog, 74.10 was the high today. 72.50, the low 72.87.5, the settlement, that down 97.5. May, 75.50, the high 74.50, the low 75.12.5, the settlement, that down 47.5. June, 78.10, the high 76.95, the low 77.47.5, the settlement, that down 62.5. July, 74.82.5, the high 73.70, the low 74.02.5, the settlement, that down 65. February bellies, 87.30, the high 86.60, the low 87.12.5, the settlement.